Hello and welcome to The Reaction Podcast with me, Ian Martin, editor at Reaction. This is the podcast where we discuss politics, geopolitics, economics and ideas with leading thinkers and writers. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by historian and author Jade McGlynn. Jade is a research fellow at the War Studies Department at King's College London and the author of two very important books on modern Russia, Russia's War and Memory Makers, The Politics of the Past in Putin's Russia. Both of these books focus on how Russians view the war and how Russians view Russia in light of their bloody history, authoritarian regimes, and an ever more warped sense of national identity. The Kremlin has long used myth and memory to legitimize repression at home and imperialism abroad. Both of Jade's books, in different ways, shed light on the war in Ukraine from the Russian perspective, something that is rarely spoken about and often misunderstood. Jade, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Before we discuss your two brilliant books, let's talk about your recent experiences in Ukraine. Where exactly are you at the moment?
I'm in Kharkiv, so East Ukraine, 25 miles from the Russian border.
And what's the atmosphere like there? And also, what's the morale like?
I'd say that the mood is one of somewhere between fatalism and just getting on with it, because there's not really any other option. I think sometimes there are unrealistic expectations that in the West that morale in Ukraine will always remain ridiculously high. People are very tired, especially here. We're on our fifth air raid alarm of the day right now, and there were 10 yesterday. It's very hard to keep your morale, you know, at a very high, but there's not really any other option because everybody knows what happens in the occupied territories. Half of Kharkiv region was itself occupied for 6 months. And everybody desperately would love to live in peace, but there's just no peace option on the table and there's no good faith actor to negotiate with. So what other choice does one have?
Mm. And what's the attitude towards Zelensky, do you think? Is he still as popular as he was, or has that faded a little?
I think it's fair to say that's faded a little. I would say that in general, with people that I speak to whose minds have changed on Zelensky, they still have a lot of respect for Zelensky. There's still this, you know, great gratitude for the fact that he stayed, because, you know, particularly among the soldiers, that gave them such a huge morale boost at the very beginning of the war. But there's an increasing dissatisfaction with his inability to rein in some of his inner circle. So some of those who are around Zelensky, and there's now a lot of discussions about perhaps, you know, his political immaturity, and that might be why he's been unable to rein in some of those around him. But that doesn't necessarily mean that people have lost respect for him, I suppose, as a war leader, or respect for what he did in staying.
And what's your best estimate on how the politics are going to play out? Obviously, there aren't elections at the moment, but when elections come, what's the prognosis?
I think most people are agreed here that when the elections come, a so-called kind of party of the army, of the soldiers, of those who fought, will be the main beneficiary in any elections. So those who will want to make sure that soldiers are able to access, for example, prosthetic limbs if they need them. You know, this real focus, I think, on the soldiers and on the sacrifice they made. Hopefully it will look something, I suppose, depending on one's political affiliations, but hopefully it will look something like the kind of 1945 government, you know, a country fit for heroes. But that still feels a very long, long way away.
Mm. Are people thinking in terms of reconstruction and after the war, or is the situation so troubling at the moment? And we'll come on to the military situation in a second. Are they not yet able to think about Ukraine after the war and what a reconstructed country would look like?
No, people are definitely thinking about reconstruction. Reconstruction is happening everywhere here in just north of where I am. I'm in Kharkiv. You can go to northern Saltivka, which is kind of infamous around the world because of all of the images of those destroyed kind of Soviet high-rises, but a lot of them have now been reconstructed. Saltivka is genuinely, you know, rather a pleasant place to walk around when the sun is out, which it is not today. Though, of course, there's still many scars from the Russian shelling. There's a lot of reconstruction happening as well, even in the centre of the city, which continues to be pummeled over the last 6 months, has been really incredibly damaged. So there's still a lot of hope. There's still a lot of reconstruction. You know, the vast majority of Ukrainians still believe they will win. And there's a lot of discussions. I mean, it's quite common in Ukraine. You sort of say, okay, well, we'll do this, but that's, you know, like after victory, we'll do this or that.
Well, that's encouraging, isn't it? But then I suppose there's still the phase to come when I mean full reconstruction after peace. At the moment things are being repaired and rebuilt, but then the attacks are continuing. But is there a sense of what kind of Ukraine could be built? They're facing this choice if they hold off the Russians. They're facing this choice on the NATO question and the EU question. How do people see that?
To be honest, here I think there's a very clear cut view, which is very much of a Ukraine embedded and actually, you know, with some kind of not the leader, but a leadership role, particularly in terms of security in Europe, Ukraine within the EU, which is something that many Ukrainians want actually for the processes that are involved, not just for being in the EU, but because they believe that, you know, some of the EU regulation would perhaps be helpful for encouraging or discouraging certain tendencies within government. And of course, Ukraine wants to be in NATO, and Ukraine feels that it would also be able to bring a lot to NATO, and it's got an argument there. Beyond that, it's spoken about of the idea as of the Ukrainian intelligence services as a future sort of very much styling themselves on a kind of Mossad operation. So I think there's a very clear-cut idea of what they want to be. The only question is, how reliable are the allies, or how helpful are the allies going to be in giving them a helping hand sometimes into those structures? And secondly, whether or not it can withstand what Russia's continued efforts to destroy Ukrainian sovereignty.
What's the situation militarily, do you think? What's your assessment? I mean, it looks, for those of us who support Ukraine very strongly and think that it's absolutely essential, it's an existential question, and Ukraine has to win. How is it looking? There have been some Russian advances. It's looking a bit precarious, isn't it?
Yeah, it is looking precarious, and I think you raised a good point there. And I think about, you know, you support Ukraine, I fully support Ukraine as well, but that doesn't mean that we always need, to me as an analyst, I think that means we need to tell the truth. You know, obviously there's sometimes like security concerns, you know, but we need to tell the truth and we need to analyze from the truth. And as much as I want to turn around and say, no, Ukraine is winning, Ukraine is doing this, that doesn't help anybody, because we need to assess the facts as they are. And right now the trajectory of the war it's not great. And, you know, the common understanding here with the soldiers, the commanders that I speak to, you know, out in Donbass or up in Kupiansk in Kharkiv region, it's very much an understanding that they desperately need more materiel, because otherwise they're having to use men, and Ukraine just doesn't have the men, and also it doesn't have that mentality where it wants to use its men. It's not like Russia, you know, that's kind of the whole point of the war. So yes. It does feel a bit bleak in conversations, but I definitely wouldn't say that it feels in any way hopeless. And I mean, one of my close friends here summed it up, because I personally was feeling very upset about the situation on the front, you know, because obviously I'm an analyst, but I'm also a human being. It's upsetting to be here sometimes. And she said, well, you mustn't get too upset, because you know what? Nothing will ever be as bad as the morning of the 24th of February. We were totally alone. We had basically nothing. And we survived it. And in a funny way, it cheered me up. So,
well, it's an extraordinary story, isn't it? It's on this podcast, we've talked with various guests over the last couple of years about this, that even friends of Ukraine saw it in terms of Zelensky lasting a couple of days. He was famously, of course, offered a lift and said he didn't want a ride. He needed ammunition instead. His determination to stay. It's one of those examples in history, the difference the individual can make. He did that, and then thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians themselves, initially first in the operation just around the airport, but then in tons and tons of other examples, the Ukrainians stood their ground, fought back, exhibited incredible bravery. And if you'd said 2 years ago that Ukraine would still be in the fight, people might have been surprised.
Oh, I think if somebody could have told me that 2 years ago today, I probably would have kissed them out of joy. I remember just waiting, because you just fought, I mean, I always knew that the Ukrainians would put up a very good fight, but to be honest with you, I did think Zelensky would flee, and then I thought the fight would be more of like an insurgency style fight. But again, it does show that difference. And of course, sitting here in Kharkiv as well, where one of my friends is one of two people who essentially set up like the entire kind of communication system for Kharkiv on the first day of the war, so they could speak to people in those parts of the city that you know had ongoing fighting, and those parts just outside the city that were already occupied, so they could understand where Russian equipment was coming in, where the tanks were coming from, and target them. And this is just people. These are just ordinary people. They weren't soldiers. I mean, they were patriotic, Ukrainians who were, they weren't just sort of your average citizen. But nevertheless, you just think of all these stories, and everybody, of course, characteristically says, oh, no, this is nothing. You want to go and speak to so-and-so who did this. But there's just so many stories of just insane levels of heroism. And I really, really look forward to the day when this war is over and we can start to read all of their books and all of their stories.
2 years on from that, how do you view this question at the moment of aid? And obviously there's a question mark over American support. America has been hugely supportive, but we all understand the context of the presidential election and the forces that are at play there. So it's very difficult on the American side. And then Europe is having this strange argument with itself, where there's a lot of very pro-Ukraine rhetoric, and there has been a lot of aid, but there just seem to be blockages in the system. Europe is no longer set up as a sort of defence, military, and industrial concept, so it's having to revisit all of that. How worried should we be, do you think? Because the military aid and ammunition, it's needed now.
Yeah, it's needed now. I mean, some has started to come in. I remember I received some messages saying that, you can feel that some of the ammo is starting to come in. But realistically, I mean, from my point of view, the only thing I think that to the extent that it can, Ukraine needs to build up its own domestic systems, because increasingly it just feels like Ukraine can't really properly rely on anyone. But of course it can't do enough of its own domestic elements. So I would love to see Europeans really finally understanding, the existential nature of this war should Russia win for the European Atlantic security order. And I mean, it's facing some other existential challenges as well. But do countries in Western Europe want to live in a Europe where Russia has a veto over the security of the continent, essentially, where Russia is not just Russia as it is now, but has conquered most of Ukraine and therefore has access to its resources, a stranglehold over, what would be about 35% of the grain market, where Russia has, an entirely indoctrinated generation that's growing up right now, starting from the last couple of years? Obviously it goes back further, but it's become especially indoctrinated over the last couple of years among like the sort of nursery school and primary school age children. This is a terrifying future for Europe. So I think I mean, everybody likes a bit of flowery rhetoric, but in some ways I found it really almost angering when we had the 2 year anniversary of the war, and there were just so many politicians and other dignitaries coming to Kyiv and essentially just talking about how proud they were to stand with Ukraine, how patting themselves on the back a lot of the time. But that more needs to be done than language. You know, actions speak louder than words. And there are a number of countries, actually, that are often not very loud about their support, but provide, a really large amount. Japan would be one example. Bulgaria and Azerbaijan have also, provided quite a lot of aid at the right moment, if you see, when it was needed, without shouting about it, because it may not necessarily always be the most popular decision at home, or it may not necessarily be geopolitically that useful to them, but they've still done it. And those actions are more important, I think, than words.
Do you think, is it a question of primarily of geographical proximity, in that this, what you've explained there, seems to be, it's understood very clearly on the front line, which is in terms of what potentially could come next at some point in the next 5 or 10 years. It's understood in the Baltic states. It's understood very clearly in Finland. It's understood now more and more clearly in Sweden, and also in countries like Norway and in Poland, but then arguably not quite so much in other parts of Europe.
I think that's an aspect of it, but then that doesn't really explain why, say, for example, Norway and Denmark have been so great on this. So I think there's perhaps certain elements of Russian influence within those countries. I'm not necessarily talking about Russian spies and influence operations, though of course that's part of it, but also just sometimes, look, for the last 2 weeks or so, Emmanuel Macron has been wonderful in his speeches, so I feel bad to kind of criticize France, but traditionally there has been this understanding that, Russia's position in the continent could actually merge with, France's desire, France's vision for its position on the continent. And of course, Germany has, long-standing and sometimes quite paradoxical hang-ups to do with its historical relations with Russia, to put it mildly. Thinking in particular about its constant referencing to World War II, even which always ignores the fact that it totally destroyed the entirety of Ukraine, during that war. But so I think there are also some other cultural issues. Sure, probably for a country like Portugal, it feels very far away. But I think there are bigger issues going on, because it's not so far away for Germany.
Of course, it may also be that for those countries like Norway, Sweden, Finland, Denmark, they're not just worried about this from the Baltic perspective in terms of Russian expansionism, potentially under Putin or even a successor. They're also worried about the High North, which we're going to hear more and more about in the years to come, as you get melting, climate change. That becomes an absolutely vital trade route over the top, as it were, and an area which is going to need policing, that's going to be contested. So they're potentially, those countries are they're not just looking directly across to Russia, they're looking north as well.
I think that's a very fair point. But also, I think, still speaks to a considerable amount of strategic wisdom, because we should all be anticipating. And I think right now, the system that we currently have in place for European security on so many measures, European defence, it doesn't work. I'm not a military expert, but I really have no idea what type of war Europe is prepared for, with the current setup. And so, yes, of course, there are those elements of, looking up to the High North, the Arctic, Russia's aggressive moves there. But also, I think it's because those countries are anticipating, the future. And that's something that we all need to do, rather than pretending we can just kind of jostle along as we currently are, because that's just not good enough for our, for the security of our nations and our peoples.
Let's talk about Russia. You mentioned what's happening in Russia. In your book, Russia's War, you argue that war is sort of inherently popular and acceptable to a large number of Russians, and you explore the myths of how that has developed. Why is it? Why is this such a myth-driven culture?
I think all cultures, all nations are essentially driven by myths. We all like to tell stories about who we are, who our group is, even who our group of friends is. So to a certain extent, that's completely normal to tell stories about oneself. I think what's happened in Russia that sets it apart is the intensity of it. For a start, and there are different reasons for the intensity. One of it is the collapse of the Soviet Union, which of course then led to the need to kind of search for a new national idea. Yeltsin searched for a long time, had essay competitions, did not find it. Putin, unfortunately, in the end did come up with a sort of bricolage, but it was a bricolage made assembled from things that were already popular. And, you know, we won't understand why the propaganda works if we just do content analysis, if we just look at what is the propaganda saying. We need to understand, well, hang on a minute, why is it saying that? Okay, it's saying that because it resonates, or it resonated at one point. Why, you know, why did people tune in to watch the propaganda? And it's not because there's, you know, something essential about Russians, though Russians believe, obviously, that there is something essentialist about Russia. I would argue the opposite. I would argue that there's a specific interplay of, you know, mass psychology, of Russia's own recent history, of Russia's own position, Russia's historical lack, actually, of a nationalist idea in that, you know, in that European sense of the 19th century, you know, of we the people, as opposed to just he the ruler, this, you know, the role of the state, and other, you know, post-imperial elements.
Yes, that it's that sense in which, you know, nationalism in 19th century European terms is a liberal project, isn't it? And then Russia doesn't have that historical experience, then has the revolution. And then I suppose, does it come down to a failure or a lack of a historical reckoning with what the Soviet Union actually did and its sort of its bloody record?
Mm-hmm. I think so. And I think as well, it's kind of a backlash. So if we think about the liberal kind of paradigm of remembering, it's Germany would be the poster child. It's that idea of coming to terms with the past, admitting your, you know, your crimes and facing up to them and, you know, making acts to kind of, acting to make up for them. Whereas in Russia, it's the complete opposite. There's actually an argument that, you know, that Western approach is just trying to destroy Russian national identity. And it's written in the military doctrine of 2014. It's written in the national security strategy 2015, 2021, written in the foreign policy concept, fifth iteration 2023. These are doctrinal, strategic, conceptual documents, you know, that put it out, which sometimes makes it very baffling for me why we don't understand in the West that Russia views culture, historical memory in this very securitized way, because it's just there in all of these key documents, let alone, you know, in his interviews and his 31-minute answers on why he invaded Ukraine, talking about Monk Nestor or whatever. So I think there's a real struggle in the West to understand not just that this isn't just about the trauma of Russian history, because bluntly, you know, Ukraine's got that and some more if we want to talk about the Soviet past, but it's also about the way that the state uses those traumas and perhaps redirects them in areas that it would like to see them. So, for example, one of the interesting elements that's come out of efforts to try to communicate with soldiers, for example, who are currently on Ukrainian territory, Russian soldiers who have invaded Ukraine, has been any efforts to kind of make them angry against their superiors tend to then lead to them redirecting that anger against the Ukrainian civilians. And I think that's something that we see elsewhere in terms of, you know, some of the feelings of humiliation and some of the even perhaps historical traumas inflicted by the state, they tend to be directed against others, perhaps because they can't be directed at the state, because obviously that's a scarier way. I mean, you could argue, depends how empathetic you want to be. You could argue it's cowardice that they directed against weaker people, or you could argue it's completely natural because they don't want to be like beaten up or given an administrative fine or whatever.
Let's talk a bit about memory makers, the politics of the past in Putin's Russia, in which you explain all of that. Let's talk about propaganda. What kind of propaganda to push these ideas has the Kremlin been creating and broadcasting to the Russian people to legitimize its rule?
So there's different elements that I look at. So one of them is, you know, the state media or the state affiliated media and its use of historical framing. So the way it uses historical analogies. So ever since 2014, and this is how I became, you know, this is how I became an academic and began studying this topic. You had this constant conflation of the Great Patriotic War, so the Soviet fight against Nazism from 1941 to 1945, with Russia's aggression in Ukraine, this idea that Ukrainians were Nazi collaborators and that Russia was saving the good Ukrainians who were essentially Russian, maybe with a bit of a funny accent, from those bad Ukrainians who were funded by Western forces, who were sort of like shadowy Nazis in this narrative, and those Ukrainian nationalists were themselves Nazis in this narrative. And it was incredibly effective. I mean, people began wearing the St. George's ribbon, which has been used since around 2004 as a kind of a mark of celebrating the Soviet victory over Nazism. They started to wear it to mean that they supported Russian aggression against Ukraine. And so you had this symbol of a war that then became a symbol of two very different wars, but that were completely intermingled. And I remember when the full-scale invasion began, and people would ask me, oh, but surely nobody in Russia can believe, you know, these weird narratives about Nazis. And actually, I was surprised that they asked me, because this narrative has been around since 2014. The 2014 narrative, in turn, built on the 2004 narratives that Yanukovych used during the Orange Revolution. And even if you go back to Soviet newspapers or pro-Soviet newspapers in Ukraine around 1991, they argue against Ukrainians voting for independence because it will just lead to, you know, Nazis and Nazi collaborators coming to power. So it's actually a very embedded element of Russian understandings of Ukraine, this idea there are two Ukrainian, you know, there are two forms of Ukrainians. So that's one aspect quite specific to the war, is this use, it's a really extreme use of historical analogies, you know, and explaining the present and politics with a constant reference back to kind of historical grievances or historical traumas. The second element is popular culture. After 2012, Russia, the state founded or funded a large number of organizations that put out, you know, just a glut of World War II films, but that always have, you know, a very similar message and always have a very similar depiction of Ukrainians as either good, kind of silly country bumpkins who are essentially Russian, or bad, speak Ukrainian, wear the Ukrainian embroidered shirts and are a Nazi. And it's just that constant, it's not always the main element of the film, but it's always there. You also have the rise of a number of books called the Popadnichestvo genre, which is essentially about Russians going back, the heroes go back in time to fix bad things that happened in history. So almost this sense of addressing, you know, traumatic moments in history. And you have this proliferation of military history clubs, military patriotic clubs, sometimes for the young, but also, you know, for the old. And what's really interesting, because I did a lot of field work on this from 2012 to 2018 across Russia, is a lot of the military history clubs in particular, they were grassroots organizations. They were just set up often on the basis of some teacher or some kind of community leader. Leaders' own childhood experiences in the Soviet Union, kind of just copying that to give children something to do. And then around 2015, the state starts to come in much more systematically and to give them funding. But obviously with funding, as we all know, sometimes you have to kind of direct your movements in a certain way. But this was still very much, I think it's fair to say that up until 2015 in particular, this was very citizen-led, and there was this real desire to engage with this more patriotic history. Whereas now, when we look at it since 2022, what you see is this real formalization of many of these structures, that if even after 2015, 2016, they still kind of could look at least vaguely citizen-led, or at least, you know, it was a bit of both. Now it's very much state mandated, so it's now part of the curriculum that schools have to send children to military history and military patriotic extracurricular classes.
And how do you think, or why did the West miss all of this? I mean, why was this? Why were Western policymakers still operating under a different set of assumptions about Russia? You know, just about to just about halfway through Calder Walton's book on the epic spying war between the US, the UK, and Russia, and one of the persistent themes is how consistent Russia has been since the revolution in its view of its enemies and its conception of itself. And repeatedly, Western policymakers are naive about Russian leaders. Shouldn't it have been? I know it's easy to say with the benefit of hindsight, but shouldn't it have been more readily apparent to policymakers when a guy who's a KGB guy takes over Russia on the last day of 1999, and this stuff starts to develop? It should have been obvious earlier than it was.
Yeah, it definitely should have been obvious. And I think it certainly should have been obvious from 2012. And if not from 2012, then definitely from 2014. And I think that most people who spent time in Russia, you know, actually travelling around the country rather than just being in Moscow, could see that. But I have to say, there was a lot of pressure. I mean, just thinking back to my own PhD, which essentially looked at this exact matter, I did feel a lot of pressure from, particularly from kind of older generations of Russianists, that, oh, what I was, essentially, that what I was writing wasn't fair, it wasn't balanced, because it told this story, and that it would be much better if I focused on liberal Russia, etc., etc. So there's this real unfortunate shared tendency, I think, between policymakers and between a certain generation of Russia specialists to really over-focus on liberal Russians. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't focus on them. They definitely should be worthy of study, etc. They often the content they produce is much more interesting. I would rather read their content than, you know, watch hours upon hours of Russian propaganda, as I chose to do instead. But I think because we looked for the Russia we wanted to see, we didn't see the Russia that was.
What do you think the prognosis for Russia is now?
I think the country's gone through a total moral catastrophe, and I think the prognosis for that society can only be dire. I mean, if you turn men who are, you know, sometimes child killers, you know, killers of old grannies, into heroes, if you send them back to live in their places, you know, where they came from, so they can terrorise people, it's the ultimate sort of destruction of basic elements of right and wrong. And I don't think Russia for a long time had not been a happy place, and I think there's a lot of study that needs to be done on, you know, life in the Russian provinces and why Russians were so brutalized that their soldiers came to Ukraine and immediately began this kind of raping and mass execution of civilians, because normally it takes a little while for soldiers to become that brutalized, and yet it was happening from day one. And I think there's a lot of study to be done there. But as I say, I think that brutalization of society and that complete inversion of right and wrong, it will not lead to a happy place. I think the best thing that could happen for Russia would genuinely be defeat in this war.
Final question. What do you think this year has in store for Ukraine?
I think this year is a year for Ukraine to just survive, to be honest with you. It needs to stand, it needs to make plans for the future. It's already doing that with, you know, domestic, with increasing some domestic production, hopefully working with European allies to work out the extent to which they can stem some of the potential loss if there's a Trump presidency, or even just among political turbulence in the US, and to stand as much as possible, because things will get easier from the autumn, if not only because there's going to be a lot more ammunition coming in, there's some other aspects, but I think the idea of Ukraine being able to retake any significant amounts of land this year doesn't look very likely right now. And unfortunately, Russia's war effort continues to remain resilient and to seem pretty sustainable, at least for the next few years. I think everybody's slowly starting to finally understand there's not going to be a popular uprising, and that the only way to defeat Putin is if Ukrainians defeat him in Ukraine.
Jade McGlynn, thank you very much for joining us. We've been talking to Jade McGlynn, Research Fellow at the War Studies Department at King's College London, author of two important books on modern Russia, Russia's War and Memory Makers, The Politics of the Past in Putin's Russia. You've been listening to The Reaction podcast hosted by me, Ian Martin. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction, go to the website www.reaction.life. You get my weekly newsletter and all of the excellent journalism from our team at Reaction. Until next time, thank you for listening.